Hello everyone, welcome back to Sabbath School from Home. My name's Cameron.
And I'm Lachlan.
And Ken and Luke are unfortunately unable to join us this week, but we look forward to them joining again next week, all things being as they should. Lach, we've looked at a few longer psalms recently and had to condense and read excerpts.
Yeah.
Today we're going to look at a shorter psalm.
All right. There were actually a couple of psalms suggested as potential reading by this week's lesson, which had, I found, a little bit of a enigmatic title for the week, Longing for God in Zion.
Yeah, and we should note, like, one of those psalms is Psalms 46, which was our first ever episode was on Psalm 46.
That's right. We had to look back to check, but that's where we started.
That means this week there's a bonus episode you can listen to this week, and then you can scroll back through your feed to the very first one.
Yes.
Get two episodes on this week's topic.
Although from memory, it's worth pointing out to anyone that might have joined the podcast somewhat more recently than that very first episode, we definitely were still sorting out audio technologies at the start of COVID lockdowns, and the sound quality was not as good, if I recall correctly, in that first episode.
And the theme of our discussion centered very much on isolating. I think the catchphrase from that discussion was self-isolate and know that I am God.
Yes. Oh, the world's changed a little bit, hasn't it, since then?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but there were a number of psalms presented, and Longing for God in Zion as a title for the week, I found slightly enigmatic, because are we to be longing for God to be placed in Zion? Are we, or to be present in Zion? Are we to be longing for the God who just happens to be in Zion? I'm being a bit silly and facetious.
Are we the ones in Zion? Longing for God in Zion?
Yeah, okay.
It could mean that we're the ones in Zion,
yeah,
longing for God.
Well, the reason that this is a bit silly playing with the words, but I think the reason for acknowledging it right up front is clearly, literally, Zion being a mountain in Jerusalem, geographically constrained to a point on earth. I think as we go through this, we're going to have to try and find ways to understand a deeper meaning, rather than just simply reading the surface level of some of these words. The psalmist or psalmists very certainly wrote some of these things about the specific place that was important to them.
Yeah, and there's some that place was important to them geopolitically. It was important to them as their capital city, as their home. It was important to them for so many reasons. And of course, they lived in a time and a place where people saw gods as very territorial. Now, they had a little bit of trouble coming to the table, but they did accept that their God was the God of the whole earth. But there are still echoes of this culture. You know, I'm thinking of Naaman when he leaves to go home and wants to worship the God of Israel. He has to carry a donkey load of dirt, of Israel's dirt, home so that, yeah, he can stand on that dirt that belongs to Israel's God to worship Israel's God. So, you know, the Israelites were more, I was going to say advanced, theologically advanced than that. They did sort of recognize their God was the God of the whole earth. If you read the book of Jonah, or if you read some of Christ's statements about Tyre and Sidon and how much more friendly they'd be than the Israelites, the Jews sometimes had trouble taking it to heart that God really did care about everyone.
Mm. Mm.
And we could throw into that the last couple of chapters of Esther. But, you know, so one of the reasons I'm uncomfortable is that there's something a little bit nationalistic about,
yep,
the fervor over Zion. That may be a very accurate reflection of the culture of the people at the times, but I'm not sure what particular religious value it has. Of course, there's been times in church history where it has had huge amounts of value. And of course, the reason why King John was, you know, usurping the throne and Robin Hood had to keep him in check in Sherwood Forest, according to the legend, near Nottingham, was precisely because King Richard had gone, which is a historical fact, to the Holy Lands on a crusade.
Yeah.
Because in what year is this, like 1200s or something? Because it's post-Norman, and that's, yeah, 1066, 1100, 1200s. In the 1100, 1200s, where you can imagine what it was like to travel from England to Jerusalem.
Yeah.
It was so important to the devout believing people in England to free the Holy Lands that they travelled across to, you know, to watch. And he was away decades. Like,
yeah,
yeah,
yeah. It's true, and I guess we need to acknowledge that even today, it's for some people and in some parts of the world, outside Jerusalem and Israel, it's still a perhaps disproportionately important geopolitical thing. And of course, within Jerusalem and within Israel and the surrounding regions of the Middle East, of course, it's incredibly fraught. And at the moment, more fraught than it has been in recent living memory, probably, for at least some time. Yeah. So there's a lot of layers for us in 2024 reading this psalm or some of these psalms, isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah, there's lots of layers. Can we start, Locke, by reading the psalm? This psalm seems to describe the anticipation, the joyful anticipation of looking forward to a pilgrimage to Jerusalem.
Yeah. So this is Psalm 122, and it's got the heading, which is possibly extra biblical in my Bible, A Song for Pilgrims Ascending to Jerusalem, a Psalm of David. I was glad when they said to me, Let us go to the house of the Lord. And now here we are, standing inside your gates, O Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a well-built city. Its seamless walls cannot be breached. All the tribes of Israel, the Lord's people, make their pilgrimage here. They come to give thanks to the name of the Lord as the law requires of Israel. Here stand the thrones where judgment is given, the thrones of the dynasty of David. Pray for peace in Jerusalem. May all who love this city prosper. O Jerusalem, may there be peace within your walls and prosperity in your palaces. For the sake of my family and friends, I will say, May you have peace. For the sake of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek what is best for you, O Jerusalem.
And the truth is, like, I'm not as well informed as I could be, and maybe as I should be, I don't know, about the conflict in the Middle East. But I think it would be fairly safe to say that what is best for that location is not the sorts of strife that we're seeing here at the moment.
Yeah.
and that peace would be a welcome new development.
Yeah.
And perhaps very legitimately, we should be praying for that. Perhaps, I mean, I'm sure there's many people who are.
Mm.
But in as much as I don't think we need to pray for it, especially because it's the place Jesus was born and has a historical religious significance to us, but I think all places where things are not as they should be, we should be praying for. Like, what's the purpose of a pilgrimage, and like, what role does it play in the expression of faith? Because it has played a fairly crucial role and does play for most religions a very significant role, and in Christianity has played a significant part. When did this idea of pilgrimage go out of vogue? Is it a post-Reformation thing?
That's a great question. I don't know when it went out of vogue. In some ways, it's almost not out of vogue. We call them different things now. We call them Holy Lands tours, and we do them once we retired. I'm a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I'm not trying to be dismissive of anyone's activity in this realm. I genuinely think one of the roles of pilgrimages is just curiosity. Humans are fascinated by encountering places that have featured prominently in the important narratives and the important stories. Yeah. As I'm describing this, I think I may have been on a pilgrimage myself of sorts. Years ago, when I was a PhD student, I spent 4 weeks in Germany during my PhD working on a research project in a lab there. And I had weekends on my own in Germany and took the opportunity to do a small amount of travel in the area. It was my first time in Europe. It was my first time really of much substance outside Australia, not quite technically, but close. And one of the things that was high on my list was visiting Legoland in Denmark. Now, Denmark, of course, is not Germany, but they're close enough to be connected by rail, and on a suitably cheap Eurail pass that I could afford as a PhD student, I could travel on an overnight train and get to Denmark and visit Legoland in the town of Billund, where Lego originated. That was a pilgrimage of sorts, as well as a sort of a tourist activity. And then the other one that I did on the same holiday, holiday, there I go, calling it a holiday. It was a work trip. I was there to But on that same...
Yeah, don't cast shade on academics, international travel.
All I was going to finish this anecdote about pilgrimages, it's on my mind because I've just finished reading an interesting book about it. The very... very well-known World War II story of the Dam Busters, where a squadron of British bombers dropped innovatively engineered bombs to get around defences in order to break water reservoirs in Germany. The intention was to reduce hydroelectricity and water supply for steelmaking, to have a real strategic impact on the war and minimise the loss of life. Of course... the harsh reality of it is that if you bust open dams, you end up with great floods that rage down valleys and do cause tremendous suffering and loss of life. So there's a lot of layers to this experience and to this story. But I did travel to the Myrna Dam and the Ida Dam. And for me, that was a sort of pilgrimage. And the reason I'm connecting it is because of... you could ask the question, why did I want to do that? Well, there's a certain amount of... it's a story that had been told many times in my life, in my childhood. I'd seen the famous black and white post-World War II film called The Dam Busters.
Not only seen the film, but seen it on a reel-to-reel projector, because the science department at Avondale had, probably still has somewhere, a reel-to-reel projector in working order. And I think the only film that they had was The Dam Busters. And I remember it not quite being an annual tradition, but at least happening, you know, once every couple of years that Dad and Pa would get together and resurrect this old thing. And we'd all head in to the science department and down in one of the chemistry rooms, I think.
Yeah.
And watch the Dam Busters film.
But this is all part of it, right? So for me, visiting those specific geographic locations was partly connecting to an interesting bit of World War II history, which I was familiar with. But it was actually more than that, exactly like you've described. Cross-generationally connecting to an event and a story that had been, as you describe, one of many, but one of the stories that had significance and had been lived and relived and had been a connection across generations, you know, connecting to reel-to-reel film projectors are not something that I'm contemporary with at all. It was, even when I was young, totally archaic and fascinatingly so, like when you go to a steam train open day or something, you know, a real...
clank and click and...
Yeah, yeah. And so I think there might be something there. I can't quite put my finger on it, but I think there might be something or some things in that anecdote that help us understand pilgrimages just a tad.
I think it's a good answer, Locke. And as you were speaking, the first time I went to Europe, I visited the Myrna Dam too. so there must be some common thread here. I'm reminded of a few other things. Locke, when you drove across to Western Australia, did you stop at the big Tesla battery?
I did. Actually, I had to go out of my way a little bit because it's not very much of a tourist destination. It's not at all. There's not even, because it's a battery, there's not even any need for people on site. There's no offices. There's no tours. You just park on a dirt road and look across a field.
Yeah, excellent. So Locke and I share an interest in renewable energy, which exists at multiple levels. There's the technological interest. We're sort of technologically minded people with hobbies in that direction. There's also the ideological interest in believing that these new technologies are effective in combating climate change. And looking at that battery, I mean, if I was driving within 100 km, I'd pop up to it and have a look too. It marks a sort of a landmark. It's also a really interesting political backstory about the way industry interacts with government. And super fascinating. We won't get into politics, but about which politicians are actually willing to be led by the market. And there's some quaint ironies and interesting stories and It was the big battery in South Australia. It has now been replicated many, many times in Australia and around the world. And it marked the sort of a beginning of a shift. And it's just something we happen to care about and be interested in.
Yep.
But there is something special about being in the actual spot.
Yeah. Yeah, there it is, isn't now, there?
My kids and I have just been watching a little bit of Gadget Man. Now, Gadget Man is Richard Ayoade, a British comedian, who's perhaps better known as Moss in IT crowd. And he's super nerdy. And he does this show which is totally satirical. It's like an infomercial feature, the use of gadgets. But it's done in the most dry, oblique British humour ever. And, you know, he's on a holiday. He says, the trouble with going to places, crowds. I don't like people, he said. I'm going to sit here. And you could buy this, and he holds up a drone, which at the time of filming, the drones were sort of new technologies. And he has with him a friend, Phil Jupitus, and they're flying the drone around a castle, which they've got special permission for, and they're standing about 80 metres away from the castle, and they're looking at a screen of the castle. And Phil Jupitus says, wow, it's almost like it's just there. And then later on in the same episode, there's a similar thing where he gets a rover that's used for bomb disposal, I think, or something, and mounts a camera to it and so that he doesn't have to climb a hill. And they're sitting halfway up the hill and they're looking at a screen. And Phil Jupitus says the same thing. He said, wow, this is incredible. He said, the view is out there. And he points out to the horizon. But it's also here in high resolution or something. You know, there's this. And they sort of gush effusively with praise in a way that's obviously satirical and heaps of fun. And my boys are old enough to get the humour and they think it's hilarious. Because, of course, it is funny if the thing is right there and you're looking at a screen. It's the sort of trope we turn to for the way technology has separated us from the world. And there's a Looney cartoon of a father and son sitting down to look at a beautiful sunrise on the TV while out their window is a beautiful sunrise.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there is a sort of a sense in which we see this just sense of dislocation we have with our environment as being self-evidently comic.
Mm.
Like it's a thing which we find to be obviously odd.
Yeah, yeah.
And place, really, we would have to be the culture on Earth with the least amount of importance placed on particular places.
Yeah.
Like, ever.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah.
Well, we're less connected to place. It's increasingly common for people to be living and growing up in a different continent to three generations earlier in their family. I mean, for most of human history, that's an impossibility, not just an incomprehensibility.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is really raises an interesting question about where church is going to go, Locke, because Launceston Church, I think I've mentioned this on the podcast, is exploring the possibilities of building a new church building.
Mm.
It has gone nowhere since I last reported on this discussion. Last time we reported on it, we were speculating about what the odds were of a group of people of diverse ages, cultures, backgrounds and interests agreeing on what the church building should look like. And it all comes down to what you think a church should do. And I think the discussion is possibly a useful discussion to have, even if it doesn't end up in a new church building. But, you know, they're sort of on that journey. But there's a real possibility where you could say, well, why don't we get a commercial space with like shops downstairs, which we can put the Adra Op shop in there, and we could put a health cafe in there, and we could do what, and we could have church upstairs, and we could rent it out during the week when we don't need it, generate income that would allow us to do some good in the community. And then there's another stream of thought which says, well, actually, a church building is used one day a week, really. Why don't we just rent a space?
Hmm.
And the economic arguments of this are subtle and nuanced, and one of the reasons why this discussion's gone nowhere.
Yeah,
that shows in itself a slight disconnect with the sense of place. It tends to be the younger people who are saying, well, maybe we don't need a building of our own. And if you said to my students, current teenagers, hey, imagine you've got some cause, and for us it's our faith, but supposing you've got some cause that you really believe in that you're going to devote 10% of your income and one day a week to.
Yeah.
Write a list of everything you would do. None of those students would write down, purchase a block of land and build a building.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting.
What's the pilgrimage of the future going to look like? Is it like in 60 years' time, like will people of our generation be hopping on MSN Messenger and MySpace and going nostalgically back to the
right, to the yeah, social a media digital nostalgia.
And it'll become really retro that everyone will like, it'll be cool. You'll go there, you know, once a year onto MSN Messenger with all your friends and
yeah.
And well, do all the actually abbreviations. And
that's kind of interesting, isn't it? Some of those might be difficult because the actual tech moves on so far. You know, you can't go back and celebrate MySpace if MySpace no longer exists at all. I'm actually not sure if it does or not. That's how long it's been since I've stopped to think about it.
Yeah.
But even, you know, I alluded before to the allure, the enduring allure of steam trains. That's like a technological pilgrimage of a sort. And, you know, there may be other things where, well, I mean, one that I happen to think, but not everyone yet agrees with me, internal combustion engine cars.
Yeah.
I believe electric cars are so compelling that they're probably going to take over for almost all daily and usual tasks. Internal combustion engine cars will still exist and be drivable, just like you can still ride behind a steam train. But they will be doing so in a different context. The context will be a context that's connected to nostalgia. It's connected to memory.
Yeah.
It's how many memories do people have in cars? The smell of cars, the sound of cars. It's evocative. It's evocative of significant moments in our lives and travel and trips and you know, again, I think this is actually not nonsense because I think it does connect with some of what makes pilgrimages tick. I think, you know, if we get back to Psalm 122, it's describing, let us go to the house of the Lord. It's excited, standing just inside the gates of Jerusalem, you know, verse 2. And the verse 5. Here stand the thrones where judgment is given, the thrones of the dynasty of David. Well, that's evocative. It's regardless of when the psalm was written, that is language that is pulling into focus this idea of I'm at the place. I'm at the place where it all happens. I don't think we do pilgrimages, certainly not the same way, but I think there are elements of our lived experience that gives us access to what the mindset is behind pilgrimages.
Yeah, we send our primary school students to Canberra on a trip.
And
can I say this? I laughed, Locke, when you said this is the place where it all happens, because when we went in grade 6 to Parliament House, we went to see Question Time.
Yeah.
And there was some particular scandal going on at the time. I can't remember what it was. And the opposition were asking some very pointed questions. And I believe it would have been John Howard, wouldn't it?
Almost. Yeah, it would have been.
John Howard and the entire government got up and announced that they were sick of these questions. They accused the opposition of all sorts of heinous and you know, grandstanding and political scheming and whatever else, and walked out in a huge sulk. And this was what was put on display for the grade 6 students to see the wise and the great of our country at work. It was my introduction to politics.
Yeah, very true. Very true.
But that is we regard going to the spot as significant.
Mm. Mm.
And we put blue plaques. I made a joke on the last episode or the episode before about blue plaques.
Mm.
We put up, you know, blue plaques and Three Men in a Boat. The author, Jerome K. Jerome, comments that Queen Elizabeth I must have been nuts about public houses. There doesn't seem to be a single pub that she hasn't stayed in. And then he speculates about his friend. He said, suppose Harris, it's unlikely, but suppose he turned over a new leaf and became a good and great man, became prime minister, would they have to put up plaques in all the pubs he'd been to? And he says, no, there's too many of them. They'd have to put up plaques in the pubs he never visited. And people would flock there to see what was the matter with it. The only pub in the south of England, Harris never was kicked out of or something.
Yeah. You know, so.
So we do have these concepts of a pilgrimage then, but we don't have them. Oh no, I guess your Holy Lands tours.
It's not the same, is it?
It's not the same, because one of the differences between the pilgrimages as we've seen them is they're very much opt-in, and they're very much as the interest takes you.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're a Muslim, it's not opt-in.
Mm.
If you're Hindu, if you're a Christian of the Middle Ages.
Yeah, yeah.
Pilgrimages were not opt-in. They were definitely, if you can do this, you should.
Yeah, well, that's right. And that's why, so I used the word curiosity earlier in this episode. I think that's one of the weaker motivations for historical pilgrimages. There's more sense of duty. Perhaps a sort of an obligation. It's sometimes it's really explicit. It's literally connected. It's like a requirement. It's literally connected to your state of your standing within the religious community, or even perhaps your standing in the eyes of God or the gods.
Yeah.
And
it could be that the people who had been on pilgrimages were then able to retell their experiences to other people and sort of vicariously bring the experience back with them. So that there might be a sense in which going on a pilgrimage might have served the same purpose as getting a bachelor's degree in theology.
Yep.
It, you know, someone who had been on many pilgrimages, there might be a sense in which it equips you or was seen to equip you as being wise in the faith and able to impart truth to other people.
Mm. That's a really interesting thought. Educational pilgrimages. I think you're right.
If we were going to, because I think it is fair to say that that while there are some elements, so for instance, like we're recording a podcast which is available anywhere around the world, and at never any point in the last 4 years have the four members of this podcast recorded a podcast all in the same room.
Mm.
I don't, at least if we have, it wasn't all four of us on the podcast. I think you and I have done it in the same room once on holiday, and Luke and I might have done one once. But we've never managed all, because it just doesn't matter.
Yes.
And we can share this. So that's a sense in which our sort of sense of, I was going to say a dislocation from a sense of place, but dislocation implies a separation from a sense of place. That's what the word means. So,
yeah.
There's our general dislocation it brings many benefits to our lives.
Yeah.
Brings many benefits to our lives. But I am happy to assent and would say, probably in my own personal experience, that something has been lost.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what could be a modern equivalent? If I was to write this psalm about an aspect of being a Christian in Australia, what cultural translation could you make in this psalm that would still carry the sort of essential idea?
I think one of the things that is significant about place is that it's shared. So my mind is immediately going to shared experiences. Maybe one of the things that we do is we put value on shared communal experiences instead of shared communal spaces or places. So I'm not quite sure how that would look, and I'm trying to think of an example. You know, the psalm says, I was glad when they said to me, let us go to the house of the Lord, and now we're here, we're standing in the gates. What if it was, I was glad when they reminisced with me about Century's End Pathfinder Camporee at Tabulum. And you can't say, and now here we are, but you can say, and now I am, now we're enjoying reliving the memories conversing over our favorite events. I think it's a little weak, but I'm wondering, the reason that it slightly works is because of that sense of sharedness of communalness.
Yeah, because of course one of the features of the Jewish faith is that they all went to Jerusalem at the same time. It was like big camp. And if they changed the location of big camp, it would still be big camp.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe, but I mean, we still like are struggling to articulate any sense of real belonging to a place.
Yeah,
because these people are happy not because Jerusalem belongs to them; they are happy because they belong to Jerusalem.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's something where the Indigenous cultures of Australia can teach us something. I think it's in the Crocodile Dundee film, which is obviously not the most serious articulation of Australian culture and Australian Indigenous culture, but there is, I think it's in that film, one of the Aboriginal characters says, you know, arguing over who owns the land is like two fleas arguing over who owns the dog.
Mm.
You know, the Australian Indigenous people have a strong sense of place.
Yes.
And that, you know, place has a real significance to them. Okay, so the question is, I'm sure God is more than capable of inspiring a group of people who are trying to follow him into creating significant and meaningful experiences.
Yeah.
So maybe God will just say, hey, in the digital age, culture's changed a bit and the technology's changed a bit. I will work with my community of faith and they will together find, and maybe we're going to be creating a new thing. Maybe there isn't a sense in which pilgrimage needs to carry over.
Yeah.
But then again, maybe we're missing out on something.
Well, could it be, and this is totally speculative because I haven't stopped to reflect on this very much. It's just occurring to me. Could it be that we are missing out on something, but that traditional cultures that did physical pilgrimages were also missing out on something? In other words, it's not just that one, they're different. It's not one is better than the other. Yeah. Sure, we've lost something, but have we possibly gained something that they didn't have that they could have also valued but wasn't available to them, technologically or culturally or, you know. It's at least possible to imagine.
Same with steam trains and electric trains, or with petrol cars and electric cars. It is different, more suited to our culture and our needs and our resources and our capacity.
Yeah.
But we have lost something of that romance of rail travel, for example.
Yep.
That's a thing which is just lost.
Yeah.
There's not many places in the world where rail travel has a romance. You know, the Orient Express and the Trans-Siberian Railway and the Ghan and the whatever, these sort of iconic things. So maybe we've lost something, but of course our children growing up will still have, you know, really fond memories of the cars they drive in.
Yes. Yeah.
My kids still like going on the trains, even though they're electric trains.
Yeah. And then we can travel by air in a plane, which was something that you know, a couple of generations ago was just not possible. The rail might have been steam and emotive and warm and audio visual and visceral and all these amazing things. We've lost a bit of that, but our tech has meant that it's possible to fly to Germany to visit some dams.
So I guess then sort of I would summarize by saying that, you know, our prayer needs to be, first of all, let's be really respectful towards people who do have a specialness of a place. You know, I find this difficult, Launceston Church, because I don't actually like the church building. It's cold in winter and it's hot in summer and there's inadequate windows in the kids' Sabbath schools. And it's, you know, but at the time it was built, it was quite a nice building. But there are people in the church who contributed money, old people whose parents put money into that building. And it does have a sense of specialness.
Yes.
I think we need to be really, you know, it is not right for us to disparage people just because it is not as meaningful for us does not mean there is not a genuine purpose that this place is playing in their religious life. I think we ought to be on the lookout for special places, places we can go back to.
Yes.
Places where we can go back and we can say, oh, that's the spot I was baptized, or that was the spot where this happened, or that was the spot this happened. And for us to maybe there's something, a good reason for us to go out of our way to identify a particular spot.
Yeah.
Say, do you know what? Once a year I'm going to go, or once every decade I'm going to go to this spot because I had a really meaningful experience of God there, and I'm just going to make it a priority to go back to that spot and think about that. But then also let us be on the lookout to see what new dimensions of religious life
yes.
we might be able to find in our cultures that might be genuinely quite different to anything that was available to the psalmist.
Yep. I think those are great thoughts. We haven't really dwelt too much on the praying for peace. There's not a lot that needs to be said about that. We should be praying for peace in Jerusalem. We should be praying for peace in our own churches, in our own yeah. lives, in our families and friends. I think, yeah. Verse 8, for the sake of my family and friends, I will say, may you have peace. It's a pretty good yeah. sentiment in an awful lot of contexts.
Absolutely. Look, we might leave it there among the clock. And I think that's a good place to wrap up. Thank you very much, dear listener, for joining us. Dare I say it, Locke, this recording is a pilgrimage of sorts for me. It's a sort of a touchstone in my week where I say, no, I'm going to think about
yeah.
a psalm.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to think about a topic with friends to explore ideas and learn and think of something new. And we hope that this podcast is of interest and benefit to you. Please share it with anyone who you feel would enjoy it and join us again next week.